We're at Mem Vav, Amr Aleph, the second line, the fourth last word on the line where it says, Amr Rabbi Yirmiya, Bar Abba. Our Mishnah taught us about the rabbinic oath of a sakhir, meaning a worker who claims from his employer that he wasn't paid his wages yet. The employer says, no, I did pay you. Mishnah taught us that the Rabbanan enacted, the worker has the right to swear to his claim that he wasn't paid, and then he could collect. Mina Torah, the Torah law here would be that no shvu at all would apply. And the employer would win the case, being in possession of the money under dispute. However, the Rabbanah made an enactment here, recognizing the fact that this employer, who was busy running his business with the other workers, might be misremembering. Therefore, the Rabbanah said the worker swears that he wasn't paid and he collects, as opposed to the type of oath that the Torah always imposes, which is that the defendant usually swears and, through that oath is exempt from payment. Gemara today begins with the following question. Amar Rabbi Yirmiya Bar Abba, Sholchumi Bei Rav L'Shmuel. Bei Rav sent the following question to Shmuel. Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, teach us, our Rebbe. We want to know, if let's say Uman Omer Shtayim Ketzatzteli, the worker, for example, claims to his employer that you stipulated to pay me 2 Saloim coins for this job. Hala Omer Lo Ketzatzti Lecha Lachas. The employer responds, I only stipulated to pay you 1 Sela for this job. Yeshiva Rav asked Shmuel, Mi Nishba? Who swears in this case? Yeshiva students of Beirav presume that there is an oath in this case too, where the dispute is not whether the worker was paid or not, but rather how much wages were stipulated. The question was, who swears? Does the worker again swear and collect the 2 slime? Or perhaps does the employer swear here that the wages were only 1 sela, and therefore he's exempt from paying that additional sela? Amr Lahen Shmuel answered them, Bizu Yeshova Balabayas. In this scenario, the employer would swear that the wages were only 1 sela, V'yafsiduman, and upon swearing, the worker would lose out on that extra sela. And the rabbinic enactment empowering the worker to swear and collect does not apply here, because ktsitsa vademitka tchirienshi. The issue of how much wages were agreed upon is not something that the employer tends to forget. He might lose track, did I pay this worker or not? But his memory is generally reliable on the issue of, how much did I agree to pay this worker? Therefore, we follow the regular model where the defendant swears and then is exempt from payment. Gemara questions Shmuel's ruling. Iniv, is this true? But vai v'hatani Rabba bar Shmuel. Rabba bar Shmuel taught the following brisa. Brisa also discusses this case where the dispute was not about, was he paid or not, but rather katzatz. It was about how much this employer had agreed to pay this worker for the job. Says the brisa, the halacha here is, hamotzi mechaveira la varaya. The burden of proof is on the worker. He would have to prove that, let's say, his claim that 2 slime were stipulated is true. So the Gemara observes that the Brisa appears to be saying that v'ilo maisi raya paka. Since all the Brisa says is that the burden of proof is on the worker, that implies that if he's not successful in actually proving that the wages were 2 slime, then the employer simply can remove himself. He's simply exempt even without taking an oath. So the question, of course, is that if Shmuel's ruling above is true, why would the Braisa imply this? The ruling should be that even if the worker cannot produce a proof that the agreement was for 2 slime, higher wages, than what the employer claimed, the employer should still be required to swear to his claim that the wages was, let's say, only for 1 sela, and only then should the worker lose out on the additional sela. So the Braisa seems to be not like Shmuel. However, the Gemara answers, Amar Rav Nachman litzad in ketani. Really, the Braisa's language is only addressing, one side of the issue. It is, the Braisa is only discussing the halacha from the vantage point of the worker, what is required of him to win the case. That is, O mevi raya v'yitol, the Braisa tells us, the only hope for this worker is if he can produce a proof, can somehow prove, witnesses or otherwise, the wages here were for the higher amount, the 2 salayim. The Braisa is not getting into what is required of the employer to actually win the case. The Gemara suggests that the Braisa would agree that assuming that the worker is not able to produce a proof, then there's still one more step. The employer has to do something. He would still first have to swear that it was really the lower amount, just 1 sela, and then the worker would lose the case. Therefore, the Gemara says the rice is not a problem for Shmuel. Gemara asks another question on Shmuel Meisve from a different brisa, which says, "Hanosin talisa leuman." If somebody had given his garment to a professional, to a worker, to do some job with it, after the work was done, the owner came to pick up his repaired garment, and a dispute arose as to how much money they had agreed on here. Uman amar getzat zalish time. The worker claimed that you agreed to give me 2 shalim for this job. But the owner says, not true, I only agreed to pay you 1 shalim for this job. Says the Braisa, the halacha here is as follows. Kolz man shetalis biyad uman. As long as the actual article of clothing is still in the possession of the worker, the halacha is, the burden of proof will be on the owner of the talis to prove that the price here was only the 1 shalim. Until he can prove that, the worker can hold on to the talis and demand the 2 shalim that he claims they agreed on. Based on the principle of a motzi min chaver ul avaraya, the burden of proof is on the one who's trying to take money from the other one. If the talis is still by the worker, then really it's the owner who's trying to retrieve this talis that had the repair job done on it from the yuman. And so he, the client, the owner of the talis, will have the burden of proof. The Raisa continues, if the dispute arose after Nasnalo, after the worker had already given the repaired talis back, and the worker is now saying, okay, now give me the 2 shalim we agreed on, and the owner of the talis says, no, we only agreed for 1 shela. Raisa says, then there's an additional factor that has to be considered, which is whether we're still within the allotted time that the Torah gives person to pay his worker. That is, bismano, we're still within that time, let's say it's before sundown, then the halacha is nishba v'notel. The worker swears that the agreement was for the 2 shalim, and then he collects that full amount, the full 2 shalim, and that's the key line here that will seem to be a problem for Shmuel. The Braisa continues, if, however, avar zmano, was already beyond the time where, you know, at this point, it's a biblical transgression on the part of the client, you know, not to pay the worker. Halacha is a motzi mechaver al avaraya. We would then say the burden of proof is on the worker to prove that really there's more money here, he didn't pay the full wages. For the presumption is that a person would not violate the biblical transgression to withhold the wages after sundown, assuming the money became due by day. And therefore, there's an assumption that he did, you know, pay this person in full. He says, we agreed on 1, I paid you the 1. We believe that claim in this situation. Again, if the dispute happened only beyond the biblical deadline. But here's the point from this braisa that's relevant to our discussion, to Shmuel's ruling. Problem for Shmuel is, bizmano mi anishba v'notel. The braisa clearly says, as long as it's still, you know, before that biblical deadline, we have this dispute about the amount of the wages, not a question was he paid. The question is, you know, how much were the wages? The braisa says, the ruling is, the worker swears the wages were higher and he collects the full amount. According to the ruling that Shmuel said, am I? Why does the Braisa say this? The Braisa should have said, like Shmuel, that Yeshava balabayis v'yafsir uman, that the opposite, the employer, this client, should be the one to swear, and then the worker will lose that extra sela. It's pretty clear that this Braisa is saying, not like the ruling of Shmuel. The Gemara answers, Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, he says it's true, the Tan of this Braisa evidently does not agree with Shmuel's ruling. However, this doesn't refute Shmuel's ruling for Homani, who is the author of this braisa, Reb Yehuda. This braisa is going like the opinion of Reb Yehuda. The Omar calls man sheshvua nota etzal balabayis sacher nishba v'notel. Reb Yehuda says that any time a biblical oath has been obligated, for example, where the defendant admits to part of the claim, if the dispute involves employer, a worker, even if the particular dispute is the amount of wages, it is the opinion of Reb Yehuda, we grant the right to swear to the sachir, to the worker. He swears and collects that full amount. The Gemara is saying that that's Reb Yehuda's opinion. A minority view. Shmuel, though, was stating his ruling in accordance with the majority opinion, the Rabbanan of Reb Yehuda. They would agree with Shmuel that no, we don't grant the right to swear to the worker if the fight is about the wages. Rather, the employer gets to swear because he's not going to forget about how much wages they had set. So the employer swears that he had agreed only to the lower amount and that he does not have to pay the greater amount being claimed by the worker. Of course, our job now is to identify, you know, where is this opinion of Reb Yehuda? Where is the indication that specifically Reb Yehuda holds of the Braisa's ruling that the worker swears and that the Rabbanan would disagree? So the Gemara starts this search. Hi, Reb Yehuda, which Reb Yehuda are we referring to here? If the intention is Rabbi Yehuda of our Mishnah, the Gemara points out you have no basis at all from what Rabbi Yehuda says in our Mishnah. For if anything, you see the opposite from our Mishnah, seemingly. For if you look at Rabbi Yehuda's opinion in the Mishnah, what you find is that Achmure Kamachmir, Rabbi Yehuda is more strict on the question of the worker's right to swear. He limits the worker's right to swear in the Mishnah, as we'll explain. And so it's totally illogical to use what Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah said to conclude that, Rabbi Yehuda is extra lenient on the worker's right to swear. Rabbi Yehuda says that even in the case of wages, the worker has the right to swear, but the Rabbanan argue. If you're looking at the opinions of the Rabbanan and Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, then if anything, it indicates the opposite. For Ditznan, we learned in our Mishnah, what did Rabbi Yehuda say there? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda was disagreeing with the first opinion, and we're calling the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan had introduced us to the Shvua, the Rabbanan, that applies by this Sachir. That is, if the worker says he wasn't paid, the employer says you were paid. The Rabbanan said, even though the worker is completely denying owing the worker anything, the Rabbanan came along and enacted that we grant the worker the right to swear and collect the wages that he says he didn't receive yet. Comes along of Yehuda in the Mishnah to say, not true. No, we don't let the worker swear here. In this case, the employer would simply win the case. Wouldn't have to pay the worker a penny. There would not be a rabbinic oath on the worker, said Yehuda in the Mishnah, Achit teheisha miksa soda, unless the employer had admitted to part of the claim. He said, no, I paid you part of the wages. In which case, of course, a biblical oath is generated that you normally would say the employer has to swear about the portion that he is denying. Yehuda says, in this situation, the Rabbanan came along and shifted the right to swear from the employer to the worker. The Gemara is pointing out that there's zero indication from Yehuda's opinion in the Mishnah that he is extra lenient in terms of letting the worker swear. Just the opposite. He's being more stringent than the Rabbanan on the general question of, can the worker swear? So Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah is not a source at all. So the Gemara identifies a different source. Ela Rabbi Yehuda de Braisa. Rather, when we use the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda to answer the question above, we're referring to Rabbi Yehuda of the following Braisa, the Tanya. The Braisa says, Sachir, when you have a worker that's in a dispute with his employer about his wages, the halacha is, kol zman shelo avar alav zmano, reze nishba v'notel. As long as we're before that biblical deadline, which points its transgression for the employer to withhold the wages, halacha is that the Rabbanan granted the worker the right to swear and collect the amount that he claims of the wages. V'im lav, but if it's beyond that time, inu nishba v'notel, then we no longer allow the worker to swear and collect for the reason we explained earlier. The Raisa continues, V'yomer Reb Yehuda. Yehuda, however, said, Amosai, when? What kind of case would the worker be able to swear and collect? Only, for example, Vizman Shamalo, Taili Schari Chamisham Diner, Shishli Biyadcha. But let's say the worker is claiming to the employer, give me the 50 dinar that you owe me for the work. The employer responds, his kabaltaman dinar zav. I do not owe you 50, for you already received the dinar zav, which means 25 silver dinars. You already received half of the wages, I only owe you another 25. Oh, Shamrla, or for example, and here's the important case for us, the worker claims, shtayim ketzatzta, you stipulated to pay me 2 salaim. V'halo merlo ketzatzti l'chala achas. The employer claims, no, I only stipulated for you 1 sela. So here we clearly have a dispute about the amount of wages that was stipulated. And Yehuda is saying that as long as it's a situation of modav miktsas, where the defendant, in this case the employer, admits to part of the plaintiff's claim, then the worker swears and collects. This is our missing link right here. We have Rabbi Yehuda saying very clearly, even when the dispute is about the amount of wages that had been stipulated, the halacha is that the worker still swears and collects. Although Rabbi Yehuda makes his distinction, that's only if the employer had admitted to part of the claim. Rabbi Yehuda goes on to say, avalom or lo. But if the employer had said to this worker that it's completely not true, I don't owe you anything, so he said, I never hired you, or let's say he said to the worker, I did hire you, but I already paid you your wages. So the point is, the employer is kofra kol, he completely denies the monetary claim. Yehuda says, in this situation, there's no more halacha that allows the worker to swear and collect. Rather, we would follow the regular ruling of Amotzi Mechavel Avaraya, which says the burden of proof is on the one who's trying to take money, which is the worker. It's only, once there is a biblical oath that normally applies to the defendant, but the Rabbanan said, we're going to switch it to the worker. But if there was no oath at all because he completely denied it, then the Rabbanan did not intervene and allow the worker to swear and collect. The point again is, Rabbi Huda in this braisa very clearly says that even though it's a dispute about the amount of wages, the rabbinic enactment still applies. It says that the worker swears and collects. And so the Gemara is saying that the braisa that we studied previously that echoes this position is following this specific position of Rabbi Yehuda, but the Rabbanan of Rabbi Yehuda argue with this, and they would say, not true, the worker can't swear if the dispute is about the amount of wages. Rather, the employer would swear and then be exempt from paying that larger amount. However, the Gemara now points out that the current proposal still doesn't appear to make sense. For Maskif Lar of Shisha Breder of Edi, Shisha Breder of Edi challenge what we're saying as follows. What are we saying exactly here? Elakatzatz Rabbi Yehuda hi velo Rabbanan? You mean to say that only Rabbi Yehuda gives the worker the right to swear and collect when the issue is the ktsitz, you know, how much wages were agreed? But the Rabbanan don't give the worker the right to swear in this case? How does it make sense? For consider, hashta hechi the machmir Rabbi Yehuda, mikili Rabbanan. Since it's clear from the Mishnah, we see that regarding a case in which Rabbi Yehuda is stringent on the worker's right to swear, the disputants of Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbanan, the Mishnah, as was mentioned earlier, are lenient, and they give the worker the right to swear, even in that case, meaning where the employer didn't admit to a penny. Rabbi Yehuda in that case says the worker can't swear. The Rabbanan said, no, the worker could swear in that case. So we see that the Rabbanan of Rabbi Yehuda grant more rights to the worker in terms of swearing. And now you're telling me, Heicha de Mekel Rabbi Yehuda. Now that we've indeed established that there's a case where Rabbi Yehuda is lenient, you know, he grants the worker the right to swear, namely where the dispute is about how much wages they agreed on. Rabbi Yehuda says the worker could swear in that case. You're telling me machmiri Rabbanan? The Rabbanan, though, stringent on the worker's right to swear? How does it make sense? It seems to be, you know, constructing a position for the Rabbanan that's, you know, not consistent. But the Gemara responds, you know, where does this question really lead us to? V'yala mai Rabbanan. Rather, what would you like to suggest? You want to suggest to refute the ruling of Shmuel above and to say that even the Rabbanan agree that where the dispute is about the amount of wages, the worker still has the right to swear. The problem for that suggestion is that we know it's not true. For if it were true, V'yala tani Rabba bar Shmuel kotzat samotzi mechaver v'alav haraya mani lo Yehuda v'lo Rabbanan. If your suggestion were true, even the Rabbanan allow the worker to swear and collect, even where the dispute is about the amount of wages, and how do you account for the brayos that we learned above? That was taught by Rabba bar Shmuel, which clearly said that where the dispute is about the amount of wages, we do not allow the worker to swear. According to what you're suggesting, that brayosa is not in accordance with any of the known Tanaim, not Rabbi Yehuda nor the Rabbanan. So the point is, we know that such an opinion of the Rabbanan exists. Namely, that for some reason, the Gemara will provide a reason, if the dispute is no longer about whether this worker was paid, but is about the amount of wages, the Rabbanan say the worker does not have the right to swear and collect. Only the employer could swear and keep his money. At the same time, Rabbi Yehuda is more stringent in the sense that the worker never has the right to swear unless there was a biblical oath based on the fact that the employer admitted to part of the claim. The Gemara now puts everything together and explains how it all makes sense. Ela Amarava, rather Rav has said, this is what's happening here. Here are the different opinions. Behak and Miflagi. Here's what Rabbi Yehuda and the Rabbanan are arguing about. Let's start with Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, b'di araisa avdulei tekanta l'sachir. Rabbi Yehuda's opinion is that this whole discussion, this whole rabbinic oath, is only applicable if we have the starting point of a biblical oath. That is, if the defendant did admit to part of the claim, also now we have a biblical oath. In this situation, the Rabbanan stepped in and said, we're going to shift the right to swear from the defendant, the employer, to the plaintiff, the employee, the worker. That's all the Rabbanan said. But to be the Rabbanan, if you're talking about a case where the defendant, this employer, is being kofar hakol, is completely denying that he owes a penny, in which case the only basis to swear would be a rabbinic oath, like the Shavuos Heses we discussed previously. Would the Rabbanan say, okay, since we're still concerned, maybe he does owe this money, he should swear? But says Rabbi Yehuda, if you're dealing with an oath that is altogether only rabbinic, In this case, the Rabbanan did not on top of that say that we're going to have the plaintiff swear instead of the defendants. Why not? For Avai Tekanta, since the oath itself is only rabbinic, V'tekanta l'tekanta lo avdinan, there's a general rule that the Rabbanan don't make a double Tekanta. Don't say, okay, we have this Tekanta, now we want to make a Tekanta on top of the Tekanta. No, it's not the way it works. The Rabbanan generally make Tekanas to facilitate the observance of mitzvahs from the Torah, not to facilitate their own enactments. That's the reason that Rabbi Yehuda is, yes, stringent in the sense that, you know, if we don't have the basis here, we don't have the biblical oath based on the fact that the defendant admitted to part, then the worker has no right to swear. Whereas Rabbanan Savri, Rabbanan hold on this issue, that the Rabbanan Nami of Dinan Tekanta L'Sachir, even where the basis to swear at all is only a rabbinic obligation, nevertheless, the Rabbanan further legislated here that we shift that oath obligation from the defendant to the plaintiff, and the worker swears and collects. So yes, in this sense, the Rabbanan are more lenient than Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, you know, on the worker, but at the same time, they're more stringent than Rabbi Yehuda regarding a case where the dispute is not about whether the worker received his wages, but about the amount of the wages. For in this case, the Rabbanan say that the worker was not granted the right to swear because uketzitza mid kardachir. The Rabbanan argued that the question of, you know, how much wages did he agree to pay this worker, that's something that he probably won't forget. And therefore, the Rabbanan, you know, maintained the regular system where the defendant swears, not the plaintiff. Therefore, the employer, in this case, swears and does not pay the larger amount. That is the logic for each of these opinions. We're now turns to the Mishnah's teaching about Nigzal. If another rabbinic oath, a case where somebody was stolen from, and the Mishnah described Ketzad, what's the case, how you may eden asoshin nichnas lebesa lemashkano, etc. So the Mishnah seems to describe a case where witnesses saw a person illegally enter someone else's home. For example, a creditor illegally went into someone's property to go and illegally take security from the borrower for the loan. He's not supposed to do it that way. And later, the homeowner claims that he stole an item or items from him. The Mishnah said that the Rabbanan enacted that the plaintiff swears and collects the items that he claims the person stole, even though the defendant is saying, no, I didn't steal those things. Gemara wonders, why do the Rabbanan feel it's appropriate for the plaintiff here to swear and collect? Just because the defendant was witnessed going in to this person's house with the declared intention to go and take his security from him. Just because he said he was going to do that, maybe he didn't actually do that. So if later he denies it, he says, I didn't take anything, we should say, you know, the burden of proof is on this plaintiff to prove that this other person took his property. So that he said he would take his property, Milom Rav Nachman, for the Rav Nachman not say the following halacha, Haiman din nakid narga biyadev yamar ezel viiktale ledikla deplanya. Say someone took an axe up in his hand and declared, I will now go and chop down so-and-so's tree. And viishtakach dekotil vishadi. Later, so-and-so's tree was found, cut down, thrown on the ground. Rav Nachman said, lo amrina du katle. We do not conclude that, oh, clearly it was this person who said he was going to chop down the tree. And this person would not be liable to pay unless the plaintiff could prove that he indeed chopped it down. So Alma, we see from this ruling, Avid Inish, the Gazim Velo Avid, people who often exaggerate, issue these empty threats, and not at all necessarily follow through with it. So declared intention is not a proof that the person, you know, followed through and did it. So the question is, Achanami the Gazim Velo Avid. So we should say the same thing here. That so what, the person entered the other person's home declaring his intention to take his security, that should not be tantamount to any kind of, you know, real evidence that he in fact took anything. The Gemara answers by agreeing, you're right. If you just said he would do something, that would not be a basis to allow the plaintiff to swear and collect. But Eima u'mishkanos, we have to sort of adjust the reading in the Mishnah that actually the case is the witnesses not only witness this person entering the other person's home with the intention to take a mashkon, but they also apparently saw him actually take something. Also, of course, now we have a very significant basis to allow the plaintiff to collect. But now the question is, v'lechsi my mashkono? Oh, if the witnesses saw that, then let them simply testify what they saw the person sees from this victim, and the victim will collect. Why would we need the victim to swear it all? Just let the witnesses testify what he took. Gemara answers, Amar Rabba, Bar Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bitano Kalim and Itolin Tachas Knafav. The Mishnah's case refers to where this person left the victim's house with things, apparently, with small things that could be hid underneath the clothing. As the witnesses saw that he left something hidden under his clothing, but they didn't see exactly what it was. It was in this situation where the Rabbanan enacted that since it clearly he did take something unlawfully, and therefore the victim has the right to swear, you know, what he took, you know, even if the defendant says, no, I didn't take that, I only took this. The plaintiff has the right to swear what he says it was taken from him, and he can collect for that full amount. The Gemara relates a ruling that, you know, also talks about a situation where somebody left someone else's property with things tucked away, hidden under his clothing. Amar Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda said, Ra'u shehit min kelim tachas knafa viyatza. Witnesses saw a person carry away some things under his clothes, you know, after leaving somebody's house. Turning to Amid Beis, V'yamr l'kuchen hein biyadi. The defendant claims, though, that I purchased these things, whereas the plaintiff says, no, you do not purchase them, you borrowed them. Says Rav Yehuda, Eino Nema. The defendant is not believed to claim that he purchased these items, Rashi says, even if he takes an oath. But we'll learn now that there are many other factors to consider which might, you know, impact the final ruling. But the Gemara first of all says, V'lo amaron ela balabayis she'eno asoy limchor kelav. The ruling against the defendant here is only in a situation where the plaintiff, the homeowner, does not typically sell things out of his house. But if not, if this particular balabayis does commonly, it's typical for him to sell things, that would lend credibility to the defendant's claim and he would be believed. He would swear that he's not unlawfully taking these things for himself, that he purchased them, and then he would not have to pay. The Gemara qualifies further, even where it's atypical for this homeowner to sell things out of his house, the ruling here against the defendant, who left the house with these things hidden in his clothes, claiming that he purchased them, we only rule against him if we're talking about items that it would be unusual to hide them. If somebody will purchase them, and why would he hide them? So that is a negative indication against this defendant. Therefore, he is not believed. He has to pay because we assume, like the plaintiff's claim, that he borrowed them, and that's why he hid them. He's embarrassed. He didn't want people to see that he had to borrow these things. So there, the plaintiff wins. Avol dvarim shedarkon lahatmin. But if the items themselves are perfectly normal to hide, even if they're purchased, then neman. And that would provide a basis for the defendant's claim that he purchased these things. Why did he hide them? Because everybody would hide such things. And the Gemara qualifies further, v'she'ein darkan lahat minami. Even if you're talking about items which is normally unusual for a person to hide them, but lo amarna ala inish de lo tzinia. The defendant only loses the case if he is not a person who in general, you know, goes around in a secretive way, he, you know, hides what he's doing all the time. Rather, he's a regular person. So again, we say, you know, why are you hiding these things? It's an indication that the plaintiff's claim is true, that you actually borrowed these items, and that's why you hid them. You're embarrassed that you borrowed them. Avalinish ditznia. But if this defendant, this individual, was a person who was tznia and generally likes to hide what he's doing, well, then there's nothing that's particularly indicative of the fact that he hid these items for Hainu Arche. That's his way. He always behaves that way, and so there wouldn't be this, you know, particularly negative indication against him, and so he would be believed in that case. The claim that he purchased them. Gemara qualifies further, V'lo amaron ele ze'omer shu'ulin v'ze'omer lekuchin. The plaintiff is also only believed, even if you have all the requirements we said above, if his claim is that I lent these things out to this person, and the defendant says, no, I purchased them. In that case, the plaintiff wins. Avol begenuvin. If the plaintiff's claim was that the items were stolen, in that case, halacha is lav kol kamine. The plaintiff has no right, he's not believed to say this person went and stole the items. Because lechazuki inish beganvi lo mechazkina. We can't simply establish a person as a ganav. That is, you know, if this person has no history of being a ganav, he is presumed, you know, as far as we know, to be a kosher person, a fine person, a law-abiding person. To change that reputation, change that status, you know, that can only happen if you have, let's say, you know, two witnesses. If we know he committed a crime, fine, you can change the status. But the mere claim of this person, he says, oh, he stole from me, that claim will be rejected because we have this, you know, starting assumption, very strong assumption, that person is a law-abiding, you know, decent person until we have, you know, clear evidence otherwise. The Gemara qualifies further that v'lo amaron ela bidvar masuyin la'ashul la'aschir. The plaintiff is only believed where the items in question are items that are normally lent out or rented out. But if not, if it's not normal at all to lend out or rent out these items, then the plaintiff would not be believed. Rather, this defendant, the person in current possession, would win the case because the previously known owner's claim that he lent these items out is not a very credible claim. People don't normally lend these things out. Therefore, the defendant would win in this case. Where it says the basis for this distinction is the Shalach Rav Huna Bar Avin. Rav Huna Bar Avin said the following ruling: Dvarim Asuya L'Hashul L'Haschir, things that are normal to lend out or to rent out. Yomer Lekuchen Hein Biyadi, and the person in current possession just claims, "No, I purchased them." Einu Nem. In this case, he's not believed. So we see clearly that Rav Huna Bar Avin prefaces with, you know, we're talking about things that are normal to be lent out or rented out. If that's not the case, then we will believe the muchzik, the person in current possession. The Gemara brings further support for this. Kiha the Rava Apik Zuga the Sarbala. Rav went ahead and seized these special professional scissors used by people who fashion clothing, and also Sifra de Gadata, a book containing the Gadic teachings of Chazal, seized those things, Miyasmi, from some orphans, on behalf of a claimant who had said that he had lent them to the father who had died. Rava ruled in favor of the plaintiff, but only because these are things that are Bedvarma Suyin Lahashul Lahaschir. These are items that, indeed, it's, you know, perfectly normal to lend them out or to rent them out. Therefore, Rava ruled in favor of the plaintiff. The implication is clear. If, however, these things are not being normally lent out or rented out, Rava would have been Tainin, and he would have claimed on behalf of the orphans that, you know, maybe he really bought these things. And in that case, he wouldn't have seized the items from the estate of the orphans. So this shows us that clearly Rav agrees with the distinction we said above. Again, the Mishnah ruled that in this situation, witnesses saw, you know, a person go in someone's home and take something away. The plaintiff can swear what was stolen and collect the full amount. Amar Rav, Rav said that it doesn't have to be the homeowner himself who swears a filu shomer nishba. Even if it was a watchman who was present and he, you know, claims he saw it was stolen, he too can swear about this, and then the owner will be able to collect. And afilu ishto shel shomer nishbas, even if it was the wife of the watchman of this victim's belongings, she could swear if she saw it was stolen. She may swear about it, and then will be able to collect. In these cases, we understand, you know, why these people can sort of represent the actual owner and swear, because, you know, they're affected too. The shomer and his wife are affected parties of this. You know, they're responsible to watch this, so they could swear. Papa asked, what about Schiro Lakitamai? What if the person who claimed he saw it was stolen was a hired worker or a worker in the field who had, you know, claims he witnessed this? Could he swear? Point is that, you know, this person is more just like a bystander, is not directly impacted. So the question is whether the Rabbanan would allow this person to swear as well. The Gemara says, take or let it stand. We don't know an answer to this question. The Gemara wonders, what if Tano Bekasa de Kaspa Mai? What if the plaintiff were to claim that this thief stole a very expensive item, such as a silver cup? The question is whether he believed to swear that that was stolen, you know, because who has a silver cup? That's such a luxurious kind of item. So maybe that should make the claim suspect. Ravashi answers, here's how it works. Chazina Yinish the Amidhu. We look at this individual, we evaluate him. If we determine either that he's a wealthy person, so conceivably can own even a luxury item like this, O Inish the Mehemenhu, the Mafka the Inshi Gabe, or even if he himself is a wealthy, but if we determine he's a very trustworthy person, that many people would entrust their things for him to watch for them, then it's quite plausible that he would have this expensive item in his home and that was stolen. And so Mishtaba Vishako, he would allow him to swear that that was stolen, and he'll be able to collect for that. V'ilo. But if the plaintiff does not appear to be any kind of position or station to own such an item, then we would not allow him to swear that, you know, such a luxury thing was stolen. For, you know, we question whether he had such a thing in his possession. The Mishnah then taught another rabbinic oath in this case where somebody was witnessed, you know, entering someone's home, and he emerged clearly with at least one injury, but the defendant denies that he injured this person. Halacha is the plaintiff can swear that, no, this person did injure me, and then he can collect for the damages. The Gemara qualifies this halacha. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, lo shanu ela b'makom sheyachol lachvol ba'atmo. The Mishnah's teaching that there's a requirement for the injured party to swear is only in a situation where it's theoretically possible that he inflicted the injury on himself. But in a case where there's no such possibility, it's clear that this other person who must have damaged them, even though he's denying it, the halacha is the plaintiff may simply collect for the damages without even taking an oath. The Gemara questions this, you know, how could you be so certain that it must have been the other person who injured him? Who knows? You know, even if he himself couldn't have reached that spot to hurt himself, maybe he hurt himself on the wall. The wall inflicted the injury. The Gemara answers, Tani Rabbi Chiya, she'also lo neshicha begabo benatzila yadav. The answer is, we're referring to a case where, for example, there was like a bite mark. So it's clearly not from a wall, and it was on his back or in his torso. The point is, obviously, another person, there's no animals there, so another person did this. The only other person we know about who was there was this defendant. Therefore, in this case, no oath would be necessary. Gemara wonders, okay, even if it's clearly was an injury inflicted by another person, v'dilma acher avidlay, maybe somebody else in there inflicted the injury, not the accused, not this defendant. The Gemara answers, d'leka acher. You're right, if there was a possibility of that, there would be an oath, but we're talking about a case where there was definitely nobody else there who could have inflicted the injury. So there's nothing to discuss. It's essentially like testimony that this other person injured him, and therefore he has to pay, and no oath is required. The Mishnah then discussed this situation of kushenegdo choshed. That is, we have a situation where the defendant became subject to a typical biblical oath. Let's say he only denied part of the claim, but the problem is the defendant is choshed. He's suspect, he can't be trusted to take an oath. There's no reason to believe that he would not take a false oath. So he's disqualified from taking the oath. The Mishnah said, in this case, the Rabbanan enacted that the plaintiff instead swears and collects. And the Mishnah described, how would a person lose his credibility to take an oath? The Mishnah said, well, let's say, for example, he had previously sworn falsely. And the Mishnah said, whether that previous false oath involved a monetary case, even if it was simply a false oath where he just swore something that wasn't true, even though it wasn't in a court case, either way, even that kind of false oath would make him disqualified from now taking an oath for this case. The Gemara wonders, my afilu shvua shav. What does Mishnah mean that he loses his credibility even if the problem was that he had taken a false oath, even though it wasn't specifically in a court case, it wasn't a testimony oath, it wasn't the deposit oath? Why is that more interesting where the oath was not about a particular monetary court case? So the Gemara answers, Lomi boy kamar, the Mishnah is like building up here. It's saying not only this case, but even this case. That is, Lomi boy hanech. Needless to say that if the false oath impacted a monetary case, that would disqualify this person. He would lose his credibility to take an oath. We assume he would have no problem lying, taking a false oath. The is behu kfir as mammon. For this person has a history, he swore falsely, even though it involved other people's money. It was not only a terrible sin in the Torah, but specifically it harmed other people. So clearly in that case, he would no longer be trustworthy. Ela filo hanami. But even regarding shvua shav, where the kfir is dvarim ba'almu, where it's not hurting another person, rather it is strictly between him and God. It's of course a sin to take a false oath, but it didn't hurt anyone. It didn't affect anybody else monetarily. Still, lo mehemen, because of that too, he loses his credibility. We can't trust him to take an oath in this court case we're having today, this monetary dispute. Number one, there's once we're listing all the different oaths here, that if the person made a false one of those oaths, it would disqualify him from taking an oath today. The question is, v'lisni nami shvuas bitoy. Why did the Mishnah also teach a person who made a false shvuas bitoy? So classic shvuas bitoy would be a person swears, I will not do a certain thing. Then he goes ahead and does that thing. So that would be a sin of violating a shvuas bitoy. So why isn't it also in the Mishnah's list of sins that would disqualify him from taking another oath? The Gemara answers, because that would not disqualify him. For ki kitani shvua dechi kamishtaba b'shika kamishtaba. Because whereas the oaths listed in the Mishnah were all examples where the person uttered a false oath, so there we can't trust him to today make an oath. Avol shvuas bitoy. But in that case, if shvuas bitoy, let's say he swore I won't do something, and he ended up violating the oath, since the ikal meimar, the bekushta kamishtaba, it's entirely possible that at the time he took that oath upon himself, he was sincere. He had sincerely intended to follow through with that oath. But then, the Yitzhar later got the better of himself and he ate that chocolate cake or whatever he swore not to do. So that case, Lokatani, the Mishnah on purpose did not teach that case because indeed that would not disqualify him. That doesn't show us that he is willing to outright, make a false oath. So he wouldn't be disqualified in that case. The Gemara points out, however, that the example we gave is not the only type of scenario of a Shavuos Bitoy. And so the Gemara says, Teinach Ocha V'lo Ocha, very good, if indeed you're discussing a Shavuos Bitoy a person makes about the future. Let's say that I will eat something, I won't eat something. But Ochalti V'lo Ochalti Ma'ikal Amir. What about the other type of Shavuos Bitoy? Which is where a person swears about something that happened in the past. He swears, I did eat or I did not eat. According to one opinion, one Tanaic view, that also is considered a Shavuos Bitoy. So that is a case where if a false oath came out of his mouth, he knew, let's say, that he did not do the thing or did do that thing, and he swore otherwise. So seemingly, in this case, it should disqualify him. So the Mishnah should have listed that case too. The Gemara answers, Tana Shvua Shav. The Tana already taught a case of a Shvua Shav, an oath that was completely in vain. Let's say he swears about something that's obviously not true. He swears that this table is really a chair. The Mishnah taught us that that would disqualify him. Continuing to Mem Zayin, V'chol the Damilei. And it's understood that anything comparable to that, it is, in any case where the false oath in question was false from the moment it came out of his mouth, would also disqualify him. So the point is, yes, if you want to talk about that specific subcategory of Shavuos Bitoy, where from the moment it came out of his mouth it was a false oath, you're right. That would be essentially like a Shavuos Shav for this purpose. Since the person, went ahead and had no problem taking a false oath, you're right, that would disqualify him. And in effect, that case was already included by the Mishnah's inclusion of the case of Shavuos Shav.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD1. That's 855-275-7231.